I don't play defense.
Welcome back, coaches, to the Talking Split podcast. I am once again Rob Calder, joined today by the Metro MNT coach, Darren Best. Welcome, Bestie.
Good morning, everyone. Love the little Space Jam throwback there.
Would it be yours, Bill Murray fan?
Love it. Excellent. No, it's a Space Jam
just
fan.
Just Space Jam in general.
Yep.
Welcome, of course, as well to the Metro Women's High Performance Coach, Jenna O'Hay. Thanks for jumping in.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have everyone in. If you're able to turn on the auto downloads on the podcast app that you use to listen to this, that would be fantastic. If you're able to like, share, retweet, subscribe, ratings, reviews, anything that would help grow the podcast audience, that would be fantastic. Our podcast numbers have near on doubled since the start of the year for some reason. I like to think it's the intro. It's probably not. But either way, we do appreciate that everyone is jumping into this. A couple of housekeeping things, as always, to get through to start off with. Coach shout-outs, or someone you want to show some appreciation to that is a coach out there that is doing a ton of work. If you've got one, record it, send it through, email me, send it through. I'll read it out. I'll mispronounce the names, but I'll read it out for you and do the best I possibly can there. Book club, we've had two so far, Zoe's barbecuing book and Coops's stoicism book. Both of you would know that they are very much on brand for the world that they live in particular. We'll have another one a little bit later on today, but you can obviously record a little bit of a review of a podcast, or sorry, a book, send it on through, we'll play it on the podcast. Mike Dunlap Coaching Clinic, coming up Monday the 18th of March from 6:30 to 8:30 at Mullum Stadium. So we know Mike Dunlap has had a wealth of knowledge in basketball in general, but obviously has a great link in with Australian basketball in particular, having coached the Adelaide 36ers, but also recruited half of Australia across to play for Metro State College as well. So great clinic opportunity. One of the other opportunities coming up is the SDP team session. So, Bestie, we'll start with you. You're on the 25th of April?
March. 25th of March at Mullum. We'll go 6 till 9:30. However, it's not one, 3.5 hour session. So coaches are welcome to come at any time, jump up in the stands, see our age group, see how we go.
Yep. Jenna, 27th. So that's the Wednesday night for your girls.
Yep. And same thing.
Same deal. Yep. Same times and all that sort of stuff. What do you want the coaches to do there? Do you want them to just watch and observe? Do you want them to wander around? Like, is there anything in particular that you want from them?
Just up in the stands, in the grandstands. Yeah. So it's not a clinic as such. So there won't be interaction from the on-court coaches with you. However, it's more just a chance to come and see our environment, practice standards, all those types of things. Yep.
Yep. What age groups are these ones, Jenna?
So we've got three separate sessions. So we're starting with the bottom age under 16s, which is 2011s.
Yep.
Born. Then we go in, no, 2010 borns.
Tens,
2010 borns. Then we go into the top age of 16s, which is 2009 borns, and then the 18s.
Nothing makes you feel older than hearing like 2010 born kids are coming into like under 16 stuff. That every year I age myself further and further away from this. It is all over the place. And people that can refer to, oh, it's this year age group, I can't do it. You've got to tell me bottom age 16s, top age 16s. I'm woeful at that. Another opportunity, if any coaches have got nothing to do on a Saturday morning that are based in the country, you are more than welcome to come and spend your Saturday mornings with me out in lovely, shining Doreen. Great cafe around the corner, Magnolia on Orchard. I can recommend that. But we do have some FDP sessions running for the North, or Outer North, I think it's called, Academy. We are always looking for additional coaches. So if you want to come down, you can get on court, you can watch, you can do whatever works for you. Just send me an email and we'll try and link you in with that as best we possibly can. All right, into this week's topic. So this came to us from one of the coaches that shot me a message and said, look, you talk a lot about X's and O's and things like that, but how about we talk about some of the off-court things? So team culture and player dynamics was a really interesting topic that obviously we probably touch on every week, but we don't really talk specifically about that area in particular. No huge surprise, cohesive groups are always more enjoyable to be a part of, whether it be as a player or as a coach, always more fun when you get along, not necessarily socially, but when you get along in that world as well. You spend so much time. People talk about it with work. If you don't enjoy your work colleagues, you spend so much of your life around them, it's going to become really difficult. So hopefully you two get along and life is good in that space. But it is one of those areas too that we want to make sure our teams are high functioning in that sort of space too. So I suppose, Bestie, I'll start with you on this one. How early would you start focusing on player dynamics or team dynamics? Would you think about it in selection, or is it after teams are picked?
Definitely in selection. Yeah, I think team dynamic is always important. You know, everyone listening has either had someone, go through a trial or they've been involved in a trial, and you would know that you just don't pick the 10 best players all the time, right? Or 12, or depending on what number you're picking. You need to pick the right amount to go away and function. And some of that is personalities. You know, there's many cases where someone, you know, arguably has been quote unquote left out, right? But that is often because of behavior stuff, like there's a history there or whatever it might be. So I think it definitely is part of selection. You know, having talent is always important. You know, like we know talent wins. You have to try and tick both boxes though, I think. Like there's got to be a medium that you need to find. So, you know, it's all things. It's behavior. It's how people get along with other people. It's injury profile. You know, are you always the athlete that's sitting out? You know, that plays a factor definitely with me when it comes to selection. Yeah, so straight away with the trials, I think it's important.
Yep. How do you go about finding that though, Jenna? Like you've just been through trials, obviously, with the under-20s team and then selecting an SDP cohort as well. Is dynamics and teamwork and culture part of that selection that you went through? Like how do you even find it when it's just an on-court session for a few hours to try and look for?
I think training habits with that one is a really important one because you don't want someone who's coming into an early morning session at 6:30 who's not going to go out there and train hard because that can bring everyone else in the session down. So you need someone who's going to come out and be working hard and being a good teammate and encouraging. And I think that does go a long way. And you can see in tryouts, players who put their head down or don't give high fives. And that stuff you do notice, and it is important to, yeah, I know culture's a buzz word at the moment, but it does matter. And I think we've all heard that, oh, that person's a cancer for that team, and it can spread really quickly. And that's really important when you're putting a team together.
Yeah, you hit on the early morning session, and it's a great point. The last thing you want to do as a coach is get up at 6 o'clock to go and train kids at 6:30 and just have this flat session where no one really is super keen and Bestie's eyes have just widened up significantly. How was your morning, Bestie?
It was a little rough.
A little rough? Didn't go as
it was a little
well
rough out at FDP this morning. I think a few kids got a bit of a rocket. But what I will say is, you know, program selection and team selection is obviously two different things. And, you know, we expect any of our state coaches as part of the application process to present a depth chart. Because I know you said before you were like, you know, how are you meant to decide in a 2 or 3 hour camp or a 5 hour camp? Any coaching position that I guess of any sort of regard, so whether it was a state team, national team, or, you know, maybe NBL team, maybe even NBL one team, I would think coaches would be expected to know some background on the players that are coming or they're recruiting or all of that anyway. So if they don't, they're probably not suited for the job anyway, I wouldn't think.
Yep. No, yeah. It's a valid point. You do have to know your cohort in particular. And full transparent, I don't think we're saying anything that people don't realise. If you've already been in a program, say SDP, for 12 months, you come into the next trial with some history.
Correct.
Like straight away, it's sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Like you never really know what it's been. If your attendance has been poor, if your commitment level's been average, if your communication's been not where it needs to be, that plays a part. You can almost deselect yourself by being involved in a program just as easily as you can get selected for the next one.
100%. I find it, you know, oh, we'll be there if it's state practice. You know, oh, we'll be there if it's, you know, if it's something serious. No, everything's serious. So for me, that's red flags.
Yep. And I think there's a space, and I don't know if you've done it, so I might be talking way out of left field on this one, as I've pointed right, go figure. In particular,
it's my left.
Yeah, your left, radio left. It's one of those things too where kids have been picked in the past that are good basketballs, for sure, not elite level talent potentially, but it's just a bit of a vibe. Like they're fun, they're enthusiastic, they're energetic, they turn up, they work, they get everyone else around them better. And it's like, well, you might not be the kid that progresses, but you might be the reason that 3 or 4 others do. Mm. In that space? Like, have you had much experience with those kids, Jen?
For sure. Yep. And they are so important to have in your program and to have in your team. And they often select themselves. And yeah, they might not be the most talented out there. They might not make the most shots, but they are the people that bring the team together and make that team function and are the gel to the team. And you need that.
It is. It's such an important part of it too, though. And I think it's probably a bigger part that I've seen on the girls' side, on the women's side. Like, if you have someone that is like the linchpin that everyone gets along with socially, that they can just gravitate towards, They're good at pulling in the people that might be a little bit shy or quiet or something like that and get them involved. They're really good at keeping people's feet on the ground that might be the other end of it. They're so vital in that space. On the boys' side, it's just as big a deal, though. It's one of those areas, I think, that you can't underestimate those kids, and they don't tend to be 1 to 10 necessarily talent-wise. They might be 13 or 14, but find a way to get themselves into the 10 straight away just because they're so good at that.
Well, there's got to be a way that you can contribute to the group that's not, I guess, statistically rewarded, you know, because sometimes not everyone plays.
Yep.
You know, and I'll give a shout-out to one of our hub leads, Nick Meha. I'm sure it's not an original idea, but he has told me that at the start of each of his seasons, he has individual meetings with his players and talks to them about their expectations for playing time. You know, what do you think? And then he adds it all up, and it's always more than the 200 minutes that is allocated in a game.
We need to play 6 games to get everyone the minutes they want to play.
Correct, yeah. And then, you know, I think that's a really valuable sort of, well, guys, this doesn't work. Like, it's just impossible for all of you to get this, so someone's going to have to sacrifice. And I think that's a great exercise to do at the start of the season.
The addition to that is how many shots do you think you should get? Like, if everyone gets the same amount of shots that they think they should be getting, we should average about 312 points per game.
Coops is going to love the rate of play.
The speed in particular is out of control. But it is that kind of thing too, where everyone will have a role in a team. Sometimes your role isn't to be the starting point guard or the star center or whatever the case may be. Sometimes your role is to be the person that keeps everyone together in that space. And honestly, you can't undersell it, but it's really hard to find by the same token, because not everyone wants to play that role. Like, everyone has designs of being more.
I think it's really interesting now that the state teams are at 12 players. I think those 11th, 12th positions might not be the most talented basketball players, but they'll be someone who is accepting of a role and is happy to play that role, is happy to be in somewhat a bit of a cheerleader on the bench, but he's ready to go whenever they get in and happy to, you know, you need to go on and you need to stop this player. Yep. And that is your role on this team. And if they're able to accept that, because 12 players is hard to rotate. And so that changes the dynamic of a team.
Yeah, and just the ability to sacrifice their own game for others. I think there's a big part of it. Remember when Patty Mills first broke into the NBA, so he was at Portland at the time, and barely got on the floor. Like, just did not play. But he was almost this cult hero because he was all about, like, waving the towel and how you do it and, like, the style you do it in, and this is the...
He was a crowd favourite because of it.
Unbelievable. Like, they loved him over there, and I swear he got an extra couple of contracts out of it, because everyone's like, no, you can't cut Patty. Like, it's...
He's like, the culture dude.
Yeah, like, it'd be like shooting Bambi. You can't do that. Like, it's no good. So someone like that, that everyone just loved being around, and you talk to a lot of college coaches at the moment, and they're like, we love Australians. We love to get Australians over because they understand what the culture is supposed to look like. They're good people. They work hard. They keep everyone else together. We want more of them. Effectively, everyone's looking for the same thing. And no massive shock that you see the amount of Australians that go over there and fill a great role on a team internationally. And it's not about them and their numbers. It's about, well, will we win because we have someone that actually keeps it all together?
But a lot of the times they play themselves into a lot more minutes and play themselves into a really big role on the team because of the type of people they are. So I think that's really important to remember as well.
Joe Ingles, like, is that guy. Like, how many times does he keep getting a contract extension or something else? Because everyone's like, no, we need him on a team. He's a good person to have around the team. He'll go into bat for the younger guys when they need to go into, like, those types of things. The stories that come back are all pretty positive. So the vitality of that is important. With culture in particular, does it have to be player-driven or is it coach-driven in your experience, Jenna? Like, which one have you seen most of? Which one's worked better?
I think it's just really important for everyone to be on the same page. Yep. So I think as you get into more senior programs, I've felt like it's worked better when it's more player driven, with players holding each other accountable and being really transparent with one another. I think probably for younger age group, I think it really does need to be coach driven, because the players probably don't have the experience of being able to drive it themselves. But once the coach sets those standards and those expectations, then the players need to be held accountable for that.
Yeah, it's a great point you make. Junior kids don't know what they don't know in particular, so they might need a little bit of help. I've always been big on players do it. I'll be in the room when it's being done, but players do it. with the younger kids, I normally give them a list of like 10 words. It's like, hey, you pick whichever four or five that you really like, so that way I'm still getting what I want out of this, but you have ownership over what's going on. But it's difficult too, because in that type of a situation, loudest voice tends to win out, which is normally the most confident kid that just says, oh, I think we should do A, B, and C, and then the other seven that are like, oh, I don't really agree, but we'll just say yes to get this done, and that's easier. So it's trying to find the balance where everyone gets a say. So you might do things like, well, okay, write them down individually, put them on a piece of paper, then we'll bring it all together. So you actually get a uniformed answer rather than just loudest person in the room gets the most say in that space. What have you done in that sort of space, Bestie? Have you always driven it as the coach, or have you allowed a little bit of ownership to players?
Similar to you, like, we have a direction that we wanted to go, and a lot of the time it's because the reason we do that is because we've picked a certain type of team, you know. So if certain things are valuable to us, whether it's, I don't know, we'll use Coops as example of playing fast, and we've picked a certain team to do that, you know, we then want that to be one of our values. And if the team sets the values and the standards, that's what helps build your culture. So it kind of all intertwines together a little bit in that sense. But I think it's important to set, you know, season goals, individual goals. And then I've shared the story before about the missed block out three slides at a Nationals, which is just unbelievable that that actually happened. But those types of things, and what I've found with the younger kids, particularly, you know, even in the youth space, is when something doesn't go to plan at practice, like, I've had to stop it and just allow those two people to go and talk to each other, even if I've only got 10 players, which as a coach, like, kills you. Because as you know, as a youth coach, sometimes you lose your players to the senior team. But if something doesn't happen, so like there's maybe we're meant to be in a certain coverage or whatever it might be, and it doesn't work, and the two players know it didn't work, but they just walk off, you know, or we just move on to the next rep. You can't allow that to happen early on. You know, you've got to say like, no, you guys have got to go and connect and talk about what happened and make sure it doesn't happen again. And it makes your practice a little like stop start in the beginning. But now we're at the point where it's like they're just grabbing each other and saying, hey, yep, I've got to do this, you've got to do that, yep, good, move on. So then it starts to become player-driven. So I think in the beginning, the coaching staff should do it, but you've got to also foster that environment. You know, like you can't say, oh, you guys need to be able to get on the same page, but then you don't allow them any time to do that.
Yep.
You know, so that I think that's important.
Yeah, Coops is big on the peer-to-peer coaching. Like he speaks about it nearly every pod. He loves that peer-to-peer coaching. I watched one of his sessions a few weeks ago, and it certainly went on. Like it was evident that he's big on that, because there was no fear of anyone walking out. Like there was an under-16 kid that walked up and told an under-18 kid, hey, you're not in the right spot here. So like, geez, I'm going to be really interested to see how the 18 kid receives this. And to his credit, he's like, yep, got it. No worries at all. Yeah. So it was really interesting that if you can create that environment where everyone can deal with everyone regardless of the situation, I think it's such a fun environment to be in. And it just solves one of the problems for you as a coach, that you don't have to be the bad coach all the time, where you're always trying to hold people accountable. And it's one thing we talk about a lot, that your culture will coach when you're not around as the coach. And that should be the goal, that it's almost just this thing that runs in the background. You know when it's wrong. Like you can always find when it's wrong, but when it's going right, you kind of hear nothing about it. And I think we refer to it as the like the Spurs culture for so many years, like, oh, you know, the no dickheads policy and all that sort of stuff, like real easy one to sort of say. But because their culture was so strong with the likes of Duncan, Parker, Ginobili, they actually had a little bit of room for bend on that, where they can deal with us like, oh, you know what, we can take Stephen Jackson, because whilst he might be a little bit out there, we can deal with it in that sort of environment too. So it's really hard to try and find the balancing act. And not everyone wants to be the person trying to hold everyone else accountable. And sometimes you might want to say, hey, can you take this one? Give it back to the coach and say, look, I've tried. It hasn't worked. Can you deal with this one in that sort of world? So when you're talking like culture meetings and that sort of stuff, from your experience, Jenna, have you had like activities to build that out, or has it just been like a chat in a circle? Like, what's it sort of look like?
Similar to what you said before, sort of all get into a room together, break into little groups, and then it's like, yeah, what do we think is important for us to be successful this year, writing them down, everyone shares, and then we come together for what we want that to look like and what collectively we want. So that's sort of a little activity that I've been involved with, I feel like, many, many times.
Yeah, I was going to say you've probably done a few of these over the course of the career. And this is one of the things. I mean, you've played in obviously junior state teams growing up, national teams, international teams, different countries. Is it the same everywhere or is it a little bit different depending on where you're at in the world?
Oh, great question. This is very much an Australian thing.
Really?
In the WNBA, I don't think we ever had a type of meeting like that, ever. I think it's just train, go away, come together and do your best. Definitely no.
Yeah, right. What do you put that down to? Anything in particular or is it just a, hey, you're all pros, we trust you to be pros, go be pros, that type of thing?
Yeah, I imagine because I feel like in college it would happen.
College is an interesting one. And even still speaking to, like, we have a great network of college coaches that we speak to. And, you know, quoting another coach who I won't say it was, I just said to him, you know, so what do you guys do for culture? Yeah, we're big on culture. I'm like, yeah, so what do you do? Yeah, we're just, you know, we're big on it.
Like, okay.
So it's more like this is what's expected, just do it. There is very little, player-led sort of stuff, even in what I found being over there in college, and I think it's somewhat by design, definitely by the smaller schools, that they just punish you so much that it internally creates this cohesion from the playing group. Like this is hate revolt. Sort of. Like, not quite. You know what I mean? Like, most of the people are, like, they're all away from home, you know. It's like the team is all you've got pretty much. You know, you're always together. And it's like, we have to do it for each other. Otherwise, you just can't survive, sort of thing. And that's how it felt for me.
Yep.
You know, that we just got to do it.
And there's tons of stuff out there. Like, anyone that's been on social media ever, I feel like we'll have seen, like, David Goggins and his story coming through, like, the Navy SEALs and all that sort of stuff. And there was an article I read, it was a while ago, and it was about this thing called The Program. Effectively, which is you have a whole bunch of former armed services comes in and takes your team through, like, team building and pre-season work. And their whole thing was, along the lines of what you were saying, it was something, I think, and I might misquote this, but shared adversity builds resilience.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines. And it was like, we're just going to make it as uncomfortable as possible, where the only people you have around each other is each other.
Yeah.
And we're going to force you to get along by design, almost. I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to go about it.
But that was for the most part, my college experience.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
We had success. You know, we won a lot of games.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting. Was it something, in your, obviously, international career speaks for itself, Jenna. I'm trying to speak for her. I'm doing a horrible job of it, but it speaks for itself in that space. Do you feel like you were recruited at times because you were the right culture fit at various places, like Europe, WNBA, those types of things?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Europe, it helped that I had an Irish passport.
Oh, hey, coming back to pay off.
So I could play as a Bosman. So I think that helped with that. But I think for sure in the WNBA, I think I got a few extra contracts more because of myself as a person than perhaps my level of play for what the WNBA was and where I was at.
But we see it at all levels, though, to be completely fair. Like, we see it in the WNBL. Like, Kelly Wilson's played over 450 games. I don't think anyone's sitting there saying she's the best point guard in the league, but she's certainly a point guard in that league that helps others. She sets a standard for everyone else. Like, the infamous Kelly workouts post-training that she goes and does another workout after their training is finished is a great example of set. You need those people on your roster. You can't afford to not have them in particular.
And you should be proud of that.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? If someone's saying, you know, oh, that's the reason why they... It's like, yeah. I would love for people to say that about me.
What's wrong with that?
I reckon it's fantastic.
Absolutely it is. Yeah. I don't know why you'd want anything else. Like, that should really be almost the minimum standard, not the exception that kind of proves the rule on that. So how do you... And I'll be interested to hear from you on this one, Bestie, in particular, because you are in that beautiful grey area of youth league in particular where you've got under-18 kids that are involved, but you've got a senior program that sits above. So you almost never have your team as such, because everyone's going in four different directions. Mm-hmm. How do you manage culture in that sort of thing where there's no constant that goes on?
Yeah, well, I guess that's where it comes down to the program, you know, and the club stuff. So if you have, you know, I've been involved as a player at a youth league level where there's no connection to the seniors at all, and we had a lot of success. The seniors had a lot of success as well. So it can work. But when you've got players that are jumping around, it's important that there is that sort of club mentality. So we had a, you know, obviously NBL 1, you know, most of the players are only just sort of starting to come in now. And so a few of our guys have been up with Youth League and we've scrimmaged with them a little bit or whatever. And, you know, Casey have Preston Bungai, who's awesome dude, like really good guy, good player as well. But I have no doubt that, you know, Casey get him because of some of that other stuff. And one of our Youth League players, you know, we scrimmaged them and he kind of touched him up a little bit, which was great. You know, Preston was just killing him. And our Youth League player goes, oh, that guy, he's really good. I'm like, that guy? I'm like, go and talk to him, man. Practice has ended. Go and talk to him. He's like, oh, should I? I'm like, yes. Go and talk to him. So they ended up having like a 10-15 minute conversation after practice and they were like talking about stuff. And then the next time we play, it's like, oh, you know, now they have a chat. And so that stuff is the benefit, I guess, of having a program where it's sort of all together. And now Preston has an interest in this guy and this guy has an issue. I don't want to say who the kid is, but he has an interest in Preston and then, you know, all of that. So that helps with that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And when you look at associations in particular, the really successful ones have a great program where seniors talk to juniors and vice versa. And I think that's so important. Like just to try and get that right, where it's not just, hey, we're two completely separate programs. You do want that little bit of a blend. Like, you know, you're a Nutterwadding junior, Janet. Do you remember who the senior players were when you were coming through? Like, you probably just watched your brothers, I suppose. Didn't have much of a choice.
I did watch a lot of my brothers, but like Sam Richardson and Carly Wilson were, when I was in under 12s, they were in 18s. And I remember, you know, you'd play 6:40, 7:20 or whatever it was. So we'd play early and then I would stay back and watch them because I just thought they were the best. And so then I followed their career on from there. So yeah, I think you do remember that when you're a junior. I think it's really important.
Was it something you were conscious of when you became that senior, that you had to sort of connect with what was coming below you?
I would love to say yes, but if I'm being completely honest, I probably didn't realize the impact that I could have had. I was, I would say probably quite selfish. I just I knew where I wanted to get to. And I think it was more later in my career where I really knew the impact that I could have and I would stop and talk and make more of an effort. I think early stages of my career when I was going professional, I was just very selfish.
But you kind of have to be. Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, people hear that word and they get real funny about it, and it usually relates to they're selfish, they take 38 shots per game and everyone else only gets two. It's not necessarily that. It's more about, I'm really concerned about success. Like, I want to be as good as I can possibly be to get to wherever I want to go. I don't think it's a bad thing. It means you're driven.
I needed to get X amount of shots up in this session so I can't be distracted by someone who's watching or someone who wants to talk or get an autograph. I was there to get my work in and then off to a physio appointment or weights or, you know, I had everything that I needed to get done. So I think it was more later in my career where I gave back a lot more.
Yeah, and it, you know, obviously reflection is the easy way. Like, it's always easy after the fact. But it is one of those areas too where we do see the cohesion between the two. Well, what age did you start playing seniors? Like, on your end? Like, you would have been fairly young.
15.
Yep. What were you, bestie?
You started late though. Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I think my first ABA game was top age 18, I think.
Yep. So thinking back to those in particular, how were you treated when you were the junior first walking into the senior program? Like, what did it look like for you, bestie?
So Al Westover at the time, he was the Tigers NBL coach, and he was still involved with the juniors at that point. It was just pretty much, hey, this is Darren, he's going to help us out, and let's just keep it simple. It's first and thirds. that was pretty much it. Yeah. So from a overall, I guess if you want to call it, playbook standpoint, I felt I could just go and be okay. But from a physical standpoint, that was obviously different. Yeah.
Yep.
But that was, I think they were at that point they were accepting of it, even with the NBL guys, because, you know, they were sort of older and they just wanted to have numbers to be able to practice. So they were somewhat thankful for that. Yep, you know, it doesn't really have that situation now. You know, they've got more like DPs and all that, more of that in a sort of structured standpoint, as opposed to, hey, can you just come and help a little bit?
Well, you're probably not perceived as a threat.
Oh, definitely not.
Like when you were, disrespect, but when your top age 18's walking in, they're not sitting there saying, this kid's going to take my court time.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in this.
It was even when we came back from college. So sort of like every year we'd come back from college and like everybody would come back. And I just remember, you know, we'd get there and then we'd spill over a few courts, extra courts. And there was only, you know, depending who turned up would be over with the main guys and then the rest would be on another court. So maybe some of those guys, you could start to think, like I remember when Lucas Walker came back 1 year from St. Mary's, it was like, yeah, he'll be in the NBL soon.
Yep.
You know what I mean? You could see that was going to happen. Yeah. Yep.
What about you, Jenna? Like your first foray into senior basketball as a junior player, what did it look like?
In terms of what?
Like how accepting was the group? Did you walk in there knowing what it was going to be? Like what were the nerves like? Did anyone sort of put their arm around you and say, hey, we got you here, we'll take you along for the ride? Was there anything like that?
It's a good question, and I think different teams were a lot better than others. I think sometimes when you're young coming into a team, it's not a great environment.
Yep.
They, rightly or wrongly, want to put you in your place pretty quickly, and I found that a lot. Looking back, yeah, probably a good thing for me. I got a lot tougher and a lot more resilient probably from it. But I remember a few teams not feeling like the older people in the team treated me very well. And so later in my career when I was a leader and captain, I didn't want younger players to feel what I felt when I was younger.
Yeah, and I think that's completely fair because that's such a confronting area. And you're obviously a talented junior, so your name probably would have been across people's boards before you probably even realised they were in that sort of space. Sort of the other end of Bestie, you probably were a threat in a lot of people's eyes because they're like, oh
it's true.
She could take my spot some point. So that is something that they're genuinely conscious of. So you've got to be careful too because I've always been a big believer in blood your junior players into senior basketball as soon as they're physically ready. It was more that kind of thing. I didn't worry so much about the, you know, are they talented enough? I'm quite happy to pick the baby giraffe that falls over every 30 seconds as long as they can physically hold their own in that space.
So I'm top cool age 18s, I was starting for the Nutter Wadding Siebel team.
Yep. That's very early, as it turns out. So tough to do for a start. And Nutter Wadding's got obviously a very strong history of having very good senior teams as well. So that in itself is bloody hard to deal with. So what you put around them, how much support do you give them as the coach? Because there's an element too where it's like, well, I want this player to sort of stand on their own two feet and be okay with this group. But I think as the coach, you've also got to provide a little bit of a shield and say, hey, there's some stuff that you don't need to deal with here that I will take the ball on as the coach. That's not the easiest thing, but you've got to try and recognise that too. And I don't think that's the easiest thing for people to do.
I think it's totally changed nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, like previously, you know, having younger players play with your senior team was probably, how do I say this? It was good. Yep. Everybody wanted it. Everyone was happy to see it. And perhaps if you didn't get a result because of it, people were more understanding than what they are now.
Yep.
So now it's like NBL 1, we pay our top eight. They all have to play because we pay them. And if you don't win, we're just going to fire the coach. So it's just the truth.
Coaching.
Who would want to be a coach?
No,
it's, I'm kidding.
You know, it's just the truth. So I would say it's probably harder now for those younger kids to try and
get a chance
to break in because it's like, well, you know what? Like, and I've had conversations with several NBL 1 coaches about this, saying if you're paying players, you've got to put them on the floor. Because then all of a sudden your board is like, well, why are we paying this guy $7,000-$8,000 and he only plays 5 minutes or whatever? And then the other side of it is a lot of teams now are getting like fringe NBL guys or NBL DPs. So they're like hey, man, this is my chance to put together something in the offseason to hopefully get a contract. So they don't want to come out either.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't care if I'm down 20, up 20. It's like, no, I need to play, man.
Oh, that I need my numbers.
Guy. Yeah.
Well, it's the truth. It's
bang on, though. Like, it's absolutely right. It's every season we see numbers go up and go up and go up from players. It's like, damn, how good are they? And it's like, hold on. They lost by 30. They keep getting numbers, but they keep losing games. So are they the problem? Are they the solution, but just in a bad system? It's hard.
I find this interesting as well, because to get an NBL contract, that's not going to be their role in the NBL team.
I agree.
Bang on.
So teams out there signing these players, what are you signing them for? Are you signing them just to get big numbers, or are you actually trying to develop them to be good NBL players?
40 actually spoke about that, if you remember. He was like, stop sending me your highlight videos of, you know, tough contested twos. Did you see that video?
Yeah, I did.
He's like, because you were never going to do that for us. Right, so it's exactly your point, but I don't disagree. I'm just relaying what these coaches have told me,
which I understand from that point of view too.
I get it. Yeah. Like, at the end of the day, they like being employed as a coach. They're going to go with who they feel like are going to produce, and the 28-year-old is a more proven entity than the 16-year-old that you know is going to have some growing pains in there. They'll shoot a shot they probably shouldn't shoot. They'll try and make a pass they probably shouldn't try and make defensively. They might lack a little bit. Whereas the 28-year-old's been there around a block a couple of times. They know where to cut corners. They know what's the right shot for their system, those types of things. So I get why they would go in that direction, but it's such a hard one.
And this is why if you manage to be in charge of a senior program that wants all of that and the board don't just say they want you to do that and then, you know, get rid of you if you don't win or whatever, never leave.
Yep.
Like, just stay there. Like,
greatest job in the world.
It's great. Yeah, never leave. You know, it's good. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. And going off on a tangent here, which tends to happen 9 times out of 10 on this podcast anyway, but it is really interesting watching a lot of our players transition from junior basketball into senior basketball, those that are making the jump into NBL, WNBL, what their role is, how long before they play, how long before they play meaningful minutes in there as well. Like, it's such a hard situation, and there's a lot of people that would go to a better team, but they can actually set their career back 2 to 3 years because they may not get to play on that better team versus going to maybe a weaker team where it's like, well, I might get an opportunity to check in here because we're not going to be challenging for a title. It's that kind of thing. And, God, I don't know the answer.
I think you can look at some WNBL teams with that. There's some young, talented stars who are playing a lot of minutes for some teams that aren't doing so well ladder-wise, and there are some young stars who are on championship-contending teams who aren't playing many minutes.
Yep.
Like, at this point in careers, what is best for your development? Is it playing minutes? Is it being in a championship culture team? And I think you can look at it both ways, but it's a really interesting conversation, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think you can undersell the ability to be around a championship program either, because that is experience you cannot buy.
It is rare. It is rare. It is so hard to win a championship. Yep. If you are in a team that is in a shot to win, like, I think be around that. I think it's great because it doesn't come around very often.
No, it's a really good point. And, God, that in itself, how long is your career going to be? Like, as a development player, you're really on that tipping point of this could be it and I may never get another crack at this, or this is the stepping stone for something bigger potentially down the road. So how do you go about sort of trying to transition juniors into seniors, Bestie? Like, you obviously deal with a lot of NPP type kids that are in that world.
More of them, I guess, now it's on the boys' side. Like, the college route is still probably, it's really only the top COE kids that are going straight to NBL now. You know, I think we've had a few though. Like, we had Owen. You know, he came through NPP in that, and now he's fought his way into a roster spot with Phoenix. We had Tristan Devers, he's now DP, although he had some national team stuff where Owen didn't, whereas most still are still really going the college route, I think, and that in itself is a similar sort of challenge or question, you know, like, go to the school where you're going to play, don't go and
Sit there,
you know. So that's important. And we've said there's some great examples of what's going on at the moment of the pick and roll, that, you know, that web page or, you know, whatever. They do a great job highlighting Aussies at the moment over in America. And you just see some, like, monster performances from some kids that potentially this year were thinking about transferring. Like I heard quite a few of them were thinking about transferring and they decided to stay, you know, because they were thinking about transferring up. And they're having great careers. And I think as of right now, they're probably on some NBL radars for next year or the year after because of that. So it's, yeah, it's important to find the level, the right level for you.
It's
whether that's a developing team in the NBL, WNBL or, or, you know, a college team for the boys.
It'd be a really fascinating case study. And I'll talk to the women's side more than anything else because they're all very similar age group. The Amore, Melbourne, Shelley group that came through. And they're all Victorian, so it's really easy to speak to. But Jade Melbourne stayed and played and has found her way into the WNBA. She got drafted. Amore, who I would anticipate is going to be drafted fairly soon. Shelley, who went the college path as well, but changed colleges halfway through. Like, which one is better? It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It really is a whatever is best for you is what you need to do. But it's a really fascinating pathway for a lot of them too, because one thing I have noticed recently in particular, younger kids have no fear of rejection, of walking up to the senior coach, whether it be NBL 1 or Big V or Youth League, and saying, hey, can I play? I'm in under-16s now. Like, I want to play now.
Yeah.
They don't care. Like, they'll walk up and just, oh, what's the fear of rejection about? If they say no, they say no. If they say yes, great, I get an in. Like, it's bizarre. Like, whereas previously, it was always, you need to be asked. It's not a just walk in the door. It's almost like if the senior coach came and gave you some time, it was like the heavens opened up and this light of, you know, just shone down upon you from above. It's a really interesting sort of space to be in, I suppose, that a lot of junior players are looking to play senior basketball earlier now.
I think your example just there shows that no one person's path is going to be the same. They've all taken really different paths and they've all been really successful in their own rights, which is really great. I think like Jazz transferring and being in the conference that she's in has, it's really shined a light on her because of who she's going against. I think Amore has just been incredible. She's all over the mock boards, which is really exciting. So can't wait to see where she goes in the draft. And then Jade, her timing was really great because that COVID year was when we didn't have any imports. So she was able to play a lot of minutes and really gain confidence. And then she's just gone and done great things. Yeah. Yep. So I think all paths are really great. So for each individual, it is going to be different. So it's what works best for you.
Yeah. And when you talk about that culture, Pete, I don't know anyone that has ever met Jade Melbourne and just thought, geez, I don't really like her.
It's not possible.
It's not. Like, she's just one of those kids. And if you're going to start talking culture, see the way I brought this back, she's one of those people you would go after straight away because it's like she's been on, in all honesty, call it what it is, a losing team in Canberra for the last couple of years. But you see the improvement in her and that whole program as they've grown together. They're a lot better than they were at the very start of this process. So, and that's hard to do because if you're losing games, how do you keep the culture strong? Because it's very easy for people to turn on each other and say, hey, we're losing. I don't like this person or what's happening over there. You should be playing me more, whatever the case may be. You can tell she's got a real strong hold on what that culture looks like there. And for mine, I think that's just an incredible level of trust from Veerle to put the keys in her hands. And look, it's always easier when it's your point guard. If you're the starting center, you maybe don't get that same level. But it is one of those areas too where you just sort of see it seems like a really happy place to be at the moment. So it is interesting. One thing I wanted to jump on, leadership groups and captains. Pros and cons, Bestie, on your end. Like, what would you prefer? Would you prefer one captain? Would you prefer it spread across a few people?
Look, I think, you know, you need one officially with like court responsibilities, although it's often forgot that that person is actually designated to talk to the referees, you know.
It really happens.
Yeah. Somebody else probably goes up to talk to him and also the referee doesn't want to hear from him anyway. Yep. So there's that. You know, I think it's a good honour. You know, we just do a vote. Like, we have a preseason camp, we just do a vote. This year we ended up with a captain and two vice captains, and that was because one of our vice captains is still coming back from an ACL and is going to miss a portion of the season. So we spoke to him and said, look, you've been voted as the captain, but this guy's only like one or two votes behind you. You're not going to be here. How do you feel about that? And he goes, we should just do it together. And like that speaks towards
good. That's why they're your captain.
Yeah, yeah. Like, positive stuff anyway. But before we actually started the pod, we spoke about the pressure of being a captain and, you know, how it can negatively impact someone's performance. And we've seen it over the years, whether it's been at national championships or whatever, when someone has been voted a captain, it's sort of hindered their individual performance. And when somebody hasn't, although there's maybe some initial disappointment, it's actually allowed them to go and do what they do. So it's, I definitely don't think it needs to be your best player. Let's just like say that. I think that it's probably better when it's not.
Agreed.
I think they need to still be part of a leadership group and lead by example and stuff like that. But if you need them to really produce, you don't, you kind of just want them to be
concentrate
them.
On that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that your experience, Jenna? You obviously held a very esteemed leadership perspective in the Opals world. Was that your experience with it?
A great honour.
Yep.
Like when Sandy first said it, it didn't quite seem real. But holy wow, it is so much responsibility, and I felt like literally the world was on my shoulders and that everything fell onto me. And it wasn't just basketball side of things, it was all the off-court stuff as well. And it's just, I think it's part of the reason I retired when I did, just the mental load of captaining your country is a lot. Yep. And we... during my time, obviously dealt with some pretty crappy situations, it's a hell of a job.
Yeah, it impacts, and that's the thing. Like, honestly, you cannot undersell the burden, in all honesty, that you carry with that, because it's very different. If you're dealing with a junior team, you know, just rotate the captain. Who really cares who it's going to end up being in that sort of space? I know. One of our state team coaches once gave it to a kid that was like, why on earth would you give it to that kid? And he's like, well, he's the most likely to go to Tech because he's complaining to the refs all the time. So we'll let him be the court captain. And that way, when invariably the ref says, hey, you stop talking, it's like, well, he's allowed to. He's our captain.
It's like, a bold strategy.
Strategic.
It's a bold move, Cotton.
I just took that drop off the board as well. Oh, like, I only just had it off there as well. But it's like, well, I don't know that I'd go down this path. I've always been a believer in, look, it needs to be an important player, but it doesn't normally need to be your best player. Because they have enough to deal with.
Correct.
It's that kind of thing. It's amazing, though, how often it's gone to a vote and a kid pops up that I would not have picked a mile away. But the players all respect. And it's like, well, hey, if that's who you want and they're okay with it, I'm good with it. It's your captain, ultimately.
It's such a really good thing that you said there, Jenna, because as a coach, when, you know, I've been there where it's like, oh, man, well, let's get the captains in and let's talk to them. You know, like it's exactly...
For everything.
It's exactly what happens. You know what? Before we talk to the group, I think we should talk to the captains. Yeah.
And you know how much I love meetings. Oh, so you can just imagine the amount of meetings that was involved. Oh, man,
you're going to make me not want to do that now.
Population you, bro.
That's all I had.
I need to stop calling my captains after every practice. Yeah, man, exactly. What was that?
But there's a part of it too.
Because they're the voice of the group. That's what their role is. So I get it.
Yep. And you do want that connection with your playing group as well. And I think that's where maybe a leadership group does work a little better. Like you can spread it out a little bit. Look, we don't need to talk to all of them. We just need to talk to, we'll grab one of them at this time. And
I feel like this also gets hard though as well. Say you have a group of three or four people who think quite differently, then... How do you bring that together too?
Yep.
Because I've been involved with that where I don't think that worked very well.
Yeah, true.
Because I'm more of like just these are the facts. These are the facts. Whereas maybe another person in the leadership group is more emotional. So it's like, oh, yeah, we'll be okay. And I'm like, well, we're just – you can
space.
Be very different thoughts and thinking, which, yes, can be a good thing, but bringing all that together to be on the same page can be difficult as well.
Yeah, that's taxing for a coach too, let's face it.
And this is why, what you said earlier, it's so hard to get it right. And, you know, like,
yes,
to win, you need luck, you need health, you need, you know, so many different things. You need cohesion, like you've spoken about. You need hopefully a few... You're going to avoid a few issues, you know, like I've shared with you guys my freshman year of college, there was a bit of an incident. We'll call it what it was. There was a fight and one of the players got seriously injured. And it was just like, oh, well, we'll just blame everything on him because our season's going right. So we'll kick him out of the school. Right?
Wow.
Yeah. Because we're winning right now and we want to keep it going. Now, ultimately, surprise, surprise, it came unstuck for us, right? But... to win is so hard. It's just so hard because all these other things you need as well. It's not just talent. It's not just a good playbook. It's, like I said, health, the culture stuff, the just avoiding issues. You know, there could be so many moments in a season where things can go down, like, you know, that fork in the road type stuff where it's like we could go this way or we could go that way, or an individual could go one way and then change the course of that team for the year.
And it's just sheer luck. And a lot of times, like, you get the right draw at the right time, you might manage to catch a team that's got their two best players out injured, so it's almost a bit of a free hit. But there are times you come up against that team and it's like, because they don't have their two best players, they now play a completely different way that now doesn't suit you to play again. Like, it can go the other way just as easily in that space too. So the whole dynamic around it, and we know winning will mask near on everything. Like, if you're winning enough games, everyone will sit there and go, yeah, we're all happy. Like,
hides a good. Lot of things.
Yeah, but it really does. Like, ultimately, there's some stuff that's going on underneath. It's like, well, you know, we got to probably fix this. Do we have to fix this now? Is it something that we can wait? Then you've got to take into account, well, actually, we just had a bit of a swipe at that player at practice 2 days ago. They're still a bit flat from that. We don't want to now jump on top of this as well. And it was something that Joey Wright mentioned at the performance course late last year. He was talking about he had a leadership group. He was big on that. But he wanted different types of people in that leadership group. So he wanted one for the leader of the younger group to come in. He wanted the leader of the introverts to sort of come in. He wanted the leader of just the out there people to sort of come into it as well. And for him, he found that a little bit easier because it's like, well, if you have a problem or if you have a question, you know who the person is that your group is.
Specific roles within that.
That kind
it's
of
like,
thing.
It's like
made sense.
Like a political party leader. Really, like, is. You are the voice for the
for
the young kids.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And I don't know if he went, I didn't actually ask if he went down the path of identifying that's the person you have to go to. Like, it's not an organisational chart, but it was that kind of a thing where it's like, well, maybe that's a good way of doing it, where you do get a good cross-section. Because his thing was, I don't want three people in a leadership group that are all the same because all I get is the one message. Yeah. I want to know what my whole group is thinking in that space. But he was really big on, well, I need to have an open-door policy too. If someone does need to come and talk to me, I need them to come and talk to me, not just sit there and sit on it to the point where it's too late as well. So it's, you know, I'd love to sit there and say we have all the answers. Regrettably, we don't, because it is such a dynamic that shifts continually. And the one thing we haven't spoken about was the parent group can have a massive issue on culture as well, because if you're dealing with junior basketball, God, not even juniors, even senior basketball, depending on where you're at, the parents might have a different idea of what culture looks like or what success and performance looks like that is separate to the group. Do the parents' views line up with the players' views, with the coaches, you, all that sort of stuff as well. There's so much that goes into it. And honestly, getting it right, if you can get it right and you can get it right every year, you're a genius, because it's just hard. For mine, I don't think there's a good way to go about it.
Every team's going to be really different depending on your personnel. So what works 1 year, I can almost guarantee probably won't work the next year.
Yeah, there's no rinse and repeat, unfortunately, in team culture.
Yeah, whenever you're doing anything involving people, it's always going to be fluid. You know, we will say, you know, a lot of damage is done in the car ride home.
Yep, for sure.
We will say that, yeah.
Yep. And that's where it's probably worth getting a parent meeting at the very start and talking about what you want the culture of the parent group to be as well. It's like, well, look, you know, we're dealing with under 12 kids. We really just need them to be enjoying it. If they're not happy with something, don't try and necessarily problem solve it in the car ride, because it's, you're not going to. Just throw them a cheeseburger and the drive through of Macca's and hope for the best. But encourage the, hey, how about you go and have a chat to your coach about this and try and unpack it a little bit more on that. Obviously, as they get older, you're going to have different dynamics and those types of things too. Just quickly before we move on, favourite team building activity, Bestie?
I actually quite like the blindfolded obstacle course time trial. So we do this.
Bestie's a bit of a sadist, it turns out. He just likes seeing people trip over and fall into things.
You know what? I should bring the video up. But, like, so basically we set up an obstacle course. You go in pairs. You've got a blind, like, one person's blindfolded and the other one has to tell them where to go and how to complete it. And it's done via time, right? So a bit of communication, like, lots of laughs and all that, which is great.
Some
and
trust in there as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it always ends with you have to have a made basket, blindfolded, right, which is hilarious. Because this year we actually had a couple of guys like just go up and try and dunk it, and they were like way away from the rim, which it was hilarious. And I've got it on video for another time, but I like that one. I like that one. And then, you know, you start to talk about after that, you know, what was this about, you know, communication, blah, 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 all of that, you know. So I like that one. Yep. Yeah.
What about you, Jenna? Best like team bonding activity you've done?
Or
team building, either way.
Yeah. Pat Hunt spoke about this at the MPC camp. Just all getting into a room, splitting off into pairs. And you have a topic and person A speaks for 30 seconds about that specific topic, and then person B comes back to the group and explains what person A said, just as a way. And depending on what you want to speak about, it might be like what this team means to you or why you started playing basketball. It could be a range of topics, but just to get to know each other a bit better, which I think is important on the women's side of basketball. I think just having that camaraderie and knowledge around each other is good, and it gets them listening and communicating. And yeah, that's one he spoke about that I did with the Navy girls that I thought was good.
Yep. Mm. One, for those that haven't listened to like the early, early days of the Talking Split podcast, one that Justin Shuler threw out was Hero Hardship Highlight.
Mm.
So talk about, you know, someone that means something to you, something you've gone through that was not enjoyable and something that was a highlight. And it was just a way of getting to sort of know what everyone's about in that sort of space. The other one he spoke about was like a hot seat where someone's got to sit at the front and everyone's just got to throw compliments at them effectively about what they like about them, why they're going to be a good teammate and those types of things as well, which is an interesting one. I've never seen that.
I think that's a leading teams.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one before.
Yeah.
It's, a couple of people I maybe couldn't find some positives about. No, I'm joking. But it is.
We love that you're sitting in that chair, man. Like, you've got both feet on the ground. It's, you know.
Yeah, back straight, like eyes forward, those types of things. So there's tons of little things that you can do out there that are really good to build team. I would recommend, though, do it early in the season. Don't wait. Like, if you're.
The earlier, the better.
Your culture will unravel real quick if you just say, oh, well, let's just see how this goes. And, you know, 8 weeks in, let's try and discuss it then. Get it done as early as you possibly can.
Yeah, culture. We're big on it.
If you think that's not going to go into the intro next week, you are very wrong, bestie. All right. It is book club time.
I have many leather-bound books, and my apartment smells of rich mahogany.
All right, it is time for me on the book club this week. This is all about me. This is the culture of the podcast in particular. My book recommendation for this week is 59 Lessons by Dr. Fergus Connolly. So he's done a lot of work with high-performing teams. In particular, he's a coach of coaches, largely in that space. So work with football teams, NFL, NBA, AFL, rugby, special forces units, all that sort of stuff. So a great perspective on a number of different ways as to how teams work well, how they don't work well, those types of things. The reason I like this book is it is broken up into so many small chapters. I feel like I'm getting win after win after win if I just punch through a couple of chapters in a row. So effectively how it's broken up to is each lesson is a chapter, 59 lessons, obviously. I'll give you a tip. There is a bonus in there as well. But what it does, it tells a story as to an experience that he's had with that, gives what the takeaway is, and then shows how it would apply to sport. So what it would apply to in your world in particular. A couple of the lessons I loved... So lesson 25, you can't ride two horses with one ass and you chase two rabbits and you'll go hungry, which I really like from a, hey, dial in on what's really important. Stop trying to be a master to everything. Really find what sort of works for you. Lesson 26, I was a big fan. Take the right person, not the best person, which obviously ties into what we've just been talking about largely, which talks about sort of the human brain and the mindset, like the human, the chimp and the computer that all sit in your head in particular. Lesson 30 was great. Never buy a dog and bark yourself. Give ownership to other people. If you're going to have someone to do a role in particular, let them do that role and don't micromanage it over the top. And lesson 45, burn the boats. So go all in. So it's a great Google burn the boats for those of you that haven't had a little bit of a look at it, but effectively about don't give a way out. If you're going to go down a path, go down that path and find a way to make it work in that perspective. So tons of great takeaways in there. There is quote after quote after quote after quote. So it is a great read from that end, but an easy read. So if you are not a book person, this is a great one to actually start off with that gives you a lot out of it for mine. And I just love hearing different perspectives on sports. Like it's always fascinating to me, what is a basketball culture look like compared to a soccer culture, compared to NFL, those types of things too. So, and I'm, for some reason, I've got a real weird... interest in special forces as to how they work, because it's obviously life and death situations and those types of things. So for mine, that is my recommendation for this week, the 59 Lessons by Dr. Fergus Connolly.
Love it.
Thank you both for jumping in to the pod this week. Appreciate it greatly. We will catch everyone on the podcast again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.